G'day. Welcome to 20 things you can do right now. Well, at least if you're connected to your computers, that you can do to secure your Windows client and server infrastructure. So the first thing I want to say right off the top of the bat is that some of these things are going to be blindingly obvious to you. It's not that there's a whole lot of insane secrets about doing this. It's more that for a lot of organisational reasons, for a lot of I don't have time to do this reasons, for a lot of this would cause other issues reasons, people don't do it. But what I'm hoping is that there'll be some of the things that I'm talking about that you haven't thought about, or you haven't thought about in a particular way. And this is what security really comes down to. It comes down to this idea that security is a process. Nothing that you do is going to make your infrastructure entirely secure. Now, when I was talking just a second ago about the blindingly obvious, if we think about the two most famous security events in the last sort of 2 years, we're talking Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden. And in both of those instances, those individuals were able to get access to material that they shouldn't have had access to simply because permissions weren't configured properly. So in the case of Snowden, he was able to go through and basically spider-get everything on the NSA network. Why? Because as far as the NSA's security configuration was concerned, if you're an administrator, you can go and get anything. Bradley Manning, when he was going through all of the records that he was pulling, he was basically a low-level tech. And again, the presumption was that if you were inside the network, you were going to act responsibly. Well, what he did is he started basically surfing file shares and copying everything down and eventually handed it over to Julian Assange. So here we've got the US military and we've got the NSA, which are organisations that you would assume would have some pretty rigorous security practices, who both got undone simply by the fact that they hadn't gone through and done some of the simple stuff. And this is another lesson that we know about security, is that security is all about the weakest link. You can have, it's like in Lord of the Rings, where at the Battle of Rohan, no, not the Battle of Rohan, the Battle of Helm's Deep. It's a big wall and all of the elves are up the top shooting arrows and the orcs are down the bottom and the orcs see the drainage area and they run a bomb in there, bang, they pull down the wall. Okay, that was the weakest link at Helm's Deep. And what will happen in any security is it'll always be the weakest link. And the point I'm trying to get across is that security can be improved by taking very simple steps. It's not a matter of coming in and saying, we've got this amazing super-duper quantum mechanics biometric solution that's going to fix everything. In fact, you are going to get a lot more out of doing those small adjustments than you are going to do with the big adjustments. Now, security often concentrates on outsiders as threats. And when we think about security, we're psychologically wired to go, right, everybody outside the organisation is the problem. But as I've just said with Manning, with Snowden, with a lot of attacks, if you look at the most damaging attacks, it's often insiders or something to do with insiders that's actually caused the problem. You may be aware of a huge breach that happened last year with Target in the United States, where a whole lot of malware was put on point-of-sale devices. Well, the way that access was gained to the network was that there was a contract company that went in and did maintenance on Target's computers. And they had a standard set of accounts that they used to go and connect to all of their clients. And someone got the credentials of that account, and that's how they were able to get internal access into Target's networks. Now, this is an interesting figure, and it's sort of slightly tangential to this, and this is what I want you to start thinking about when it comes to insiders. There was a survey done about 2 years ago that found on Fortune 500 networks that 13% of them had active Tor traffic. Now, I want you to think about that for a sec. We're talking about the creme de la creme of the big American businesses. Organizations that you'd expect to be locked down tight. And 13% of them had active Tor traffic. Now, for those of you that don't know, Tor is the onion router. It's what you use when you want to anonymize the way you want to get around your proxy service. You don't want anybody tracking you. If you've heard of the Silk Road, which was a website where people sold drugs, you were in theory only meant to be able to access it through Tor. Tor is your gateway to the dark net. And yet 13% of enterprise networks had Tor traffic. Why? Because people were going through and doing other stuff on Tor. For example, file sharing, accessing illicit material. You go and throw a Tor node in, you can go and surf RedTube all you want on the corporate network because no one's going to catch you unless they're looking over your shoulder. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that's important later in terms of the generational shift. Because one of the other issues that you need to confront as people who are looking after enterprise networks is that we're no longer dealing with the sort of users that we might have had 10 years ago. 10 years ago, most of the people that you worked with were computer illiterate or barely computer literate. The generation that's coming into the workforce today grew up around computers, and they know these tricks. They might not know all the details of how Tor works, but they know that they can go and download Game of Thrones on your corporate network if they go and put this particular client on their computer, and you won't be any of the wiser as to what's going on. So let's talk about the world's most basic way of securing things, password policies. Think about your password policy. Who here has changed the default password policy in Windows Server on their organization? Okay, so about a third of you. So what are password policies? Well, they define the length of a password. The shorter the password. Now, when we're thinking about internal threats, usually when we talk about password policies, we're going, well, maybe someone's running a cracker. But that's not just it. Because if you're thinking about internal threats, is someone learning someone else's password. And if someone's trying to learn Mavis's or Doris's password, and Doris has only got a 5-character password, that's a lot easier to learn than if Doris has got a 15-character password. How complex is the password? Now, by default, you need uppercase, lowercase, numbers, and symbols, and you need 3 of those. The problem with that is that the more complex you make a password, the more difficult it is to remember, and then you have the post-it note problem, which is where someone goes and writes down their password on a post-it note. Age, how long before you should get someone to change their password? Well, again, this comes back to the post-it note problem, and you've got to think about password policies holistically. Generally, the longer you make a password, the less frequently you require people to change it, simply because it's harder to guess. If it's a short password, if it's just like a PIN number, that's a lot easier to guess, and you'd want that changed more frequently. The problem is if you've got complex password policies and they're really long, and then you are getting users to change them on a frequent basis, what you'll end up doing is getting more and more calls to the service desk as people simply forget their passwords. So, history, how often before people can reuse their passwords? Now, the trick with this one, and one that someone found, a few people have found, is that if you don't turn on password history, or if you have a short password history, what people do on password change day is that if you've got a password history of 10, they change their password 10 times so that they go back to the original password. So the way to deal with password history is sort of have a minimum length of time that someone has to wait before they can change their password again to stop the person who will, and there are people who are just sitting there going, this is an inconvenience to me, because security is always inconvenient. There is no easy way around that fact. And there's people go, well, I'm smart enough, I'm going to change my password 10 times and I'm going to go back and use the same password. So, lockout settings. Should you lock people out if they enter their passwords incorrectly a certain number of times? That one depends on your organisation. Because the moment you start locking people out permanently, what do they have to do? They have to ring the service desk. If they're ringing the service desk, that's costing your organisation money. And security is balancing the cost of the security versus what you want to accomplish. Who's been across to the United States and been in one of those endless lines at an airport? The cost of the security there is probably more than what they're trying to protect against. But that's what, you know, we call security theatre. It's the appearance of security. So when you're thinking about password policies in your own organisation, what you need to think about is, okay, if we really tighten this up, are we going to fix our problem? And it depends what industry you're in. If you're in an industry where it doesn't matter if someone's got the CEO's password, then you probably don't really care about your password policies. If you're in an industry where you are, there is an impact on someone knowing someone else's identity, then make sure you increase that. So how do you do it? You do it in group policy. Generally, you do it in group policy. So in group policy, you can configure your password policies. In Windows Server 2008 and later, there's things called fine-grained password policies where you can apply them on a per security group level. And as of Server 2012, you can actually do them a lot more simply. But you can have differentiated password policies, and the idea behind that is simply that you can require your privileged accounts to have different password requirements compared to your lower privileged accounts. So lockout policies, again, configured generally in group policy, and this simply defines what your account lockout duration is. How long do you want them locked out? You might say 15 minutes. And so if someone keeps getting locked out for 15 minutes, then you go and investigate it more. But the advantage of the 15-minute lockout is that they might not call the service desk and then have the associated costs with a service desk call. Okay, next one. This is a big threat, and this is primarily bad habits of systems administrators. Non-expiring passwords. Who here knows if in their organisation, any administrator accounts, if their own accounts or service accounts are configured with non-expiring passwords? Hands up. Yeah. All the time. Everybody does this. Why? Because systems administrators, we can go and apply those password policies to everybody else, but we don't like them applying to ourselves. So the first thing we'd go and do is we'd go and check that little checkbox that says, this is not going to expire. It's a bad security practice. There's the password never expires. Right, first thing you need to do. Here is a PowerShell commandlet that you can run. Search AD account dash password never expires. That will throw up a list of all accounts in your domain that are configured not to have their password expired. Run that command and you will be surprised, because it won't be just you that's done it. It will be the rest of the systems administration team as well. So that's a quick way of improving your security, is doing something about that. There's even a PowerShell command, which I'll show you on Friday morning, which automatically, you can automatically say, right, everybody's got to reset their password next time they log on. Not that you necessarily want to do that, because there will be some cases where you don't want that to happen. But service accounts. Service accounts. Who here has set a service account password to never expire? Right. Now, the reason for that's understandable. Service accounts. Who here has made a or knows of someone who may have put a service account in the domain admins group? Yeah, look, we're admitting here. It's like, you know, confession. It's okay. We do these things. People do these things. I mean, the reason If you ever look at a Microsoft lab environment for especially like a Microsoft course, all of this stuff is done, okay? I work on those courses, and why? Because it's a lot quicker to do it. The problem is when we're testing something and we're building it out very fast, we really slack with what we do. And then somehow it ends up in production. And all of those really bad decisions that we made because we were being slack are suddenly become policy. So, who here knows of a service account that is used for multiple service across multiple computers in their organisation? Yeah, Mr. Service Account. Let's use him for everything. That SQL Server, that SQL Server, that Configuration Manager Server, one account, all services, Domain Admins Group, non-expiring password. Or let's say you're really good and you go, well, we're going to use a separate service account, but we're going to use the same password for all service accounts. Anybody know anybody who might have done that? Yes, there's a standard. It's like the directory services restore mode password on your domain controllers, which happens to be the same thing for every domain controller in the organisation. Why? Because it's simple. Your solution for service accounts is a thing called a group managed service account. A group managed service account is a thing that you can create from Server 2008 R2 onwards. And what it does is you configure it in Active Directory and then you install it on each separate computer that you want to use it on. Now, the advantage of a GMSA is a GMSA automatically handles the rotation of the password. So you never know the password of the GMSA. When you install it, you use a special identifier for the group managed service account, and you can go and select it, and the operating system knows about it, and Active Directory knows about it, and here's a service account that's got the minimum necessary rights. You can, of course, assign more to it, but handles password rotation. So you've never got that issue where someone's gone and configured a service account and then someone compromises the credentials of that service account and then uses it to do something else. Because there have been attacks out there where administrators have known that there's a service account that everybody knows the password to, that's a member of the domain admins group, and when they want to go and do naughty things, or if they're fired, if they want to come back into the organisation later and do some damage, they log in as the service account. Why? Because the service account is configured that way. Derelict accounts. A derelict account is an account where someone has not signed on, and I use 90 days, but it might be longer. But who here has looked into Active Directory users and computers and seen an account of someone that they know is no longer part of the organisation? Who here has looked into Active Directory users and computers and seen a systems administrator account for someone who no longer works at the organisation? Yes, it happens. It's usually someone who's left the organisation. First thing you should do is disable the account. And you can do that with a single line of PowerShell. Search AD account dash account inactive minus time span 90 and then all of those things. There's 90 days. So if no one's logged on with this account for the last 90 days, go through and disable it. Because if no one's using it, there's no problem if it's disabled. Now, I'm not taking the ultimate step of deleting the account. I'm just saying, turn it off. Now, to give you an example of why this is dangerous, I went to work for a company once, and I was put in the role of network administrator, and it was my first time that I was sort of the senior systems administrator. And there was a guy who was a contractor who worked on the help desk. And there had been a guy previous to me who'd been a server administrator, had the same role. Now, this help desk guy was meant to be low privileged. And he came in while I was doing something and he said, I've had a problem with my password. Can you go and reset it for me? I said, look, come back in 45 minutes. I've got to do this and then I'll go and fix your problem. In 45 minutes, I go to find the guy. And I said, okay, which account do I need to reset? And he says, oh, don't worry about it. I used Jonathan's account. Now, Jonathan's a guy that no longer worked at the organisation who still had a domain admin account that this guy knew the password of for some reason. And he just used that. And I said, well, I'm going to go and delete that account. Oh, no, don't do that. What if we need to get into the system and we all get locked out? So that's not how it works. But he thought he was being clever. Log-on limits. Simple. Log-on limits allow you to limit when an account can be used to sign on and which computers it can be used to sign onto. So think about your sensitive accounts. Think about when they should be used. Now, sure, we've all been there at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to fix something. And maybe there should be an account that can be used at 3 o'clock in the morning to go and fix something. But most people's accounts, anybody who's doing something at 3 o'clock in the morning, you should be looking at in askance at. So you can, if you want. Now, for some of you, this will be completely inappropriate for your organisation. You'll go, no, we need 24-hour access. Fine. But for a lot of organisations, they won't. So you restrict which computers an account can be used to sign on to, and you restrict the hours where login is enabled, especially for your privileged accounts. So let's say you've got an Exchange admin account that's got all of the rights for the Exchange, and you're only using it for Exchange. Does that account need to be able to log onto your SQL box? Or should there be a separate account for logging onto SQL and doing SQL-y sort of things? In some organisation, there is that partition. And one of the things that you've got to avoid as an administrator is what I call privilege pack rat syndrome. And privilege pack rat syndrome is simply where you keep adding privileges to an account. So you've got one account that's like Green Lantern. You wish and you can do anything you want. It's got full Exchange permissions. It's got full System Center permissions. It's got full SQL permissions. Whereas if you're trying to track what an account should be able to do and what powers a person should have, then there probably should be separate accounts for each discrete utilisation. Again, different organisations have different philosophies on this, but there is a push within certain aspects of the security community to have very specific tools, accounts as very specific tools. That is, that if you need to go and log on to do Exchange work, you've got an account just for doing that so that they can track. And there's a tool called Enterprise Random Password Manager where what happens is that you go and you go sign onto a web form and you check out an account for a specific task. And then when you're finished with it, you check the account back in. And that way you can check who is performing which operation on which particular server rather than everybody having every permission that they need just in case whatever. And just in case is always a very bad sort of practice simply because it's used as an excuse for I need Exchange admin privileges just in case. No, you don't. If you need them, you go and get them. So logon hours, again, is a part of account properties, and logon workstation specifies which computers the account can be used to log on to. All of this is simply part of Active Directory users and computers. Role-based access control is something, if you've worked with System Center, something that you've worked with Exchange, you may have heard about. Who's heard about it? Who's implemented it? Well, good, some of you have. Role-based access control is simply that you limit the administration tasks that can be performed and you limit the objects in which they can be performed on. So very traditionally, with a privileged account, what would happen is that you would have one privilege over all objects. The idea with role-based access control, for example, is that you might have an administration team in Auckland and you might have an administration team in Wellington. And what you do is you can configure permissions so that the guys and girls in Auckland can manage all of the objects in Auckland, but none of the objects in Wellington. And all of the guys and girls in Wellington can manage all of the objects in Wellington, but none of the objects in Auckland. So it's about partitioning responsibility based on where responsibility lies, rather than saying, I'm going to give you this superpower over everything in the organisation. Because we're getting larger organisations that are spanning more geographic regions, and there's no reason why an administrator who's in Singapore should be able to reset the password of someone who works in Auckland, unless your organisation is structured so that that is how things are set up. So the delegation of control wizard, if you're using Active Directory, allows you to go through and delegate specific permissions over specific OUs, rather than, you know, oh, okay, I've got this help desk person, and this help desk person can go and reset everybody's password. No, this help desk person can go and reset everybody's password within their scope. Because it's not just, you know, Mavis from accounting's password that they might be resetting. It might be Betty, the CEO's password, that they're resetting and gaining access to. So, security group membership. Restrict who can modify membership of sensitive groups. Who can go and edit the domain admin's group? Use restricted groups policy to control local groups. So here we've got the domain admins groups, and we can see that the security settings of who can actually, the domain admins can go and modify that. But you don't need to necessarily go with what comes out of the box. You can go and reconfigure the permissions so that only two people actually have permission to modify the membership of the domain admins group. Now, why is that important? Because if someone, say one of your colleagues who's gone bad, they've gone to the dark side, wants to go and do something, what do? They go and create a dummy account, because they're not going to do it using their own account. They go and create a dummy account, they populate it into sensitive groups, and then they use the privileges in those groups. So you control the membership of those groups as a way of controlling who has those privileges. So you can also audit group management. So audit, who here actually uses auditing in any substantive way? Only a small number of people. And it's really understandable why. Why? Because it's difficult to do. It's very easy to build a big haystack. It's very difficult to find the needles in the haystack. Be very targeted with your auditing. But you can audit group management. So here's the policy. Audit user account management and user group management. That means that every time someone performs an operation on a user account or a security group, an event is written in the event log. And if an event is written in the event log, you've got some record of it. Because what you don't want to do is you don't want to have someone say, someone went and reset the CIO's password, but we don't know who did it. If you turn that on, at least there's a good chance that the log might exist. If you've got a really clever attacker, of course they can get around it. Because as I said, security's a process. What you're doing is you're making it more difficult, you're not making it impossible. A safe, putting something in a safe doesn't mean it can't be stolen. It just makes it a lot more difficult to steal. Putting a lock on your front door doesn't mean your house can't be burgled. It just makes it more difficult to be burgled. So, administrator auditing. Audit the activity of people who have privileged accounts. If you're an administrator, there should be a trail of what you do. I had a student I was working with who worked at a multinational bank, and they actually had a system by which anybody who logged in with an administrator account, basically a screen capture program spun up and recorded everything they did during that session so that someone could come back and look at every action that was taken when that account was being used. That's an extreme way of doing it. You can just audit the activity. Also ensure that your logs can't be tampered with by administrators. And there's solutions that you can use that are part of Windows that will allow you to do that. Or you can just ship your logs to another computer. But what you want to do is you want to have something in there. Because, of course, if you're hacking a machine, if you're attacking a machine, one of the first things you want to go and do is you want to remove any trace of that occurring. And that means resetting those logs and wiping them out. So there is an audit sensitive privilege use properties group policy item which will automatically write events to the security event log every time someone does something such as backup files and directories, configure delegation for security accounts, perform audits, impersonate a client, load and unload device drivers. Again, it can be quite noisy, but you have to have the haystack there to find the needle. You can also implement something, and I'll give you the Microsoft solution with audit collection services in Operations Manager to handle this, or you've got a whole lot of other third-party products which will take the information that's written to all of these security event logs around your organisation, pull it in, and allow you to run SQL queries and advanced queries against it so that you will be notified if there is suspicious activity. Now, changing to networking. Who here has implemented IPsec on their local network? Okay, maybe 5% of the area. Now, one of the things to understand, and you really have to watch someone like, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Troy Hunt. Troy Hunt's a friend of mine. He does develop security courses for Pluralsight. And Troy does a lot of demonstrations showing how bad applications are at keeping information secure. And the way he does that, he gets a program called Fiddler, and he proxies everything through Fiddler, and then he does a capture on it. Now, what he finds is that even applications, even banking applications that are meant to use SSL to encrypt traffic, might use the SSL certificate, but don't actually encrypt the network traffic. So where I'm coming back to with using IPsec is that who here has wireless networks at their work that are used? Okay, pretty much most of you. So if someone has access to that wireless network and the traffic is not encrypted, it means it can be captured. So consider if you are using wireless networks, doubling up on your encryption, not only using the encryption that's built into the wireless protocol, but using IPsec. So secure your network communication so that if the app isn't good, the information that's going across the network isn't necessarily captured. Use certificate-based authentication where you can, simply because then you have the ability to revoke a certificate if you think it's not being used properly, and that will sort of block that host or that user from participating in the IPsec communication. And with that in mind, domain isolation policies. What a domain isolation policy does is it's like a firewall policy, except for it uses IPsec to authenticate each end of the communication. So if you turn on a domain isolation policy, what it does is it says basically, unless I'm authorized to talk to you, I don't care what packets you send at me, I'm going to drop them. So it's not saying, okay, I'm going to accept all traffic on port 80. It's, I'm only going to accept traffic on port 80 internally if it's IPsec authenticated. Now, why is this important? Because we've talked about you've all got wireless networks. Well, most of you have got wireless networks. What's stopping someone going and getting their own device and putting it on your network and using that? So what you have to assume, and one of the things that's changed about the way that we think about networks these days, is that 15 years ago, it was very simple to turn around and say, right, everything that's over that side of the firewall is hostile. Everything that's on this side of the firewall is safe. The reality is that anybody can now go out and get a laptop that can connect to a wireless network. That means that potentially your internal network is as hostile a network environment as the internet. And I'll talk a bit more about this later on. So domain isolation policies simply say that my servers, and you just turn it on your servers and you say my file servers, all of my infrastructure servers will only communicate with a device that's authenticated. And you have a way that the devices that are not authenticated can get the certificates they need. But again, what you're doing is you're saying, right, this file server won't talk to you unless you're a member of the domain. So if you've got your MacBook Pro and you're trying to hit that file server, it doesn't matter if you can even, you've got the credentials to get to it, unless that's recognised as a device that's allowed to talk to that file server, it'll drop all of that communication. And if you're thinking about, we're going back to Mr. Snowden. Mr. Snowden built himself some virtual machines that would go out and grab stuff from file shares and from SharePoint sites because he had an unauthorized computer, but no one picked it up because he was one of the guys that was the security guy, and there wasn't the internal infrastructure to sort of deal with that. So you create those as basically part of a firewall policy, and you can do that again in group policy. So updates. Updates are really obvious. There's a get hotfix PowerShell commandlet, and we all know that computers should have updates installed. Who here just uses WSUS to do updates in their organisation? Okay, so about a third of the room. Now, WSUS is great, it's free. WSUS does not have robust reporting on which computers aren't up to date. So you can use get hotfix as a PowerShell commandlet to go through and check whether or not a hotfix is installed on a computer. Because one of the things that you might have found if you've got a product like Configuration Manager or Virtual Machine Manager is you go and do a baseline and say, right, which computers in my organisation, I'll go and put an agent on all of you, which computers in my organisation have got a specific update installed? What you'll find is that a very decent percentage of them won't have it installed. Even though you went to deploy it through WSUS, they might have been switched off. The update might not have installed for a reason. So one of the things that you need to do as part of your own sort of tightening up of your network is make sure that the updates that you have deployed are actually being installed. I'm taking it as given that you actually deploy the updates in the first place, but that you are actually checking that that deployment has been successful. You've got a tool called the Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer. I'll show you a screenshot in a minute. That goes through and it just checks computers. You basically point it at a network segment, you point it at the domain, and it'll go through and check. Has everybody got every update that's actually they should have? You can also, if you're going to spend a bit more money, go and use Configuration Manager and configuration baselines, which will go and check to see whether a specific set of updates are installed. The other thing that's important about updates is to make sure that you keep your operating systems up to date. Who here still has Windows XP machines? Okay, about 10%. Who here is still running Server 2003? Okay, you've got less than a year before 2003 falls out of support. So in theory, by the middle of next year, you should be off Server 2003. It is a lot more difficult to keep an older operating system up to date simply because of the magnitude, the number of the updates that have been released since it was released, than it is to keep a newer operating system up to date. Newer operating systems are by nature more secure simply because Microsoft and other operating system vendors have learnt a lot by fixing their older operating systems before they come to their newer ones. So this is the Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer. You can download it for free from Microsoft's website. You do need administrator permissions on the computers you can run it again. It's not some beautiful vulnerability scanner that you can run at everybody and say, hey, you haven't got all of those updates installed. It does assume that you have admin permissions. Okay, NAP. Now, NAP is a technology that, without putting finer point on it, failed. So network access protection, the idea was that computers would only be allowed onto the network if they were up to date. And the reason I say it's failed is if you looked at the Windows Server 2012 R2 documentation, NAP is deprecated, which means that in some future release, NAP's not going to be there anymore. So if you've got NAP now, it's supported. If you're thinking about deploying NAP, don't, because at some point in the future, Microsoft's retiring it. And even if you go and take some of the Server 2012 or 2012 R2 courses from Microsoft Learning or read some of the books I wrote, the training kits, we have NAP in there. Why? Because it's still on the exam objectives, even though this technology's been deprecated. Why? Because the announcement of the deprecation came later than the generation of the exam objectives. But what NAP was really good at and what it's still useful at doing is actually coming through. You can put it into reporting mode. So rather than blocking someone from coming onto the network, what NAP in reporting mode does is it just sends a report in and says, right, this person does not have up-to-date antivirus software. They have not performed an update check in, you know, a long time, and they don't have their firewall running. And that's another quick way, using technology that's just built into the operating system without actually having to purchase anything extra, that you can get an idea about your organisation's state of health. So BitLocker, what's BitLocker good for? BitLocker encrypts your hard disks, primarily used with portable computers. You can encrypt the disks of desktop computers, you can encrypt USB sticks. Why is this important? It's important because in the United States each week, 6,000 laptops are left at airport security checkpoints. I don't know what the number is in New Zealand or Australia, but I've talked to security people and they've said, no, you're right. There are a sizable number of computers that are simply accidentally left, that someone goes through the security checkpoint, they put the thing in the blue bucket and they come out the other end and they walk off and they've forgotten about it. And some of them get picked up and some of them don't. However, all of the information that's sitting on that computer may or may not be critical to your organisation. There's an interesting statistic that for the average cost of replacing a laptop for an organisation, and this comes from the Ponemon Institute, is $50,000. Now, when I usually say, wow, it's $50,000 to replace a laptop, they're thinking, gee, you know, Steve Jobs or Apple's making a lot of money on laptops these days. but it's not the cost of the chassis that's important. The biggest cost in replacing a laptop is figuring out what data was sitting on that laptop. That means tasking someone to figure it out and then working out what the potential impact of that data going public is. Because very few organisations, especially the more senior someone is, the more critical the data is on the laptop. And it might not be. It might be that it's not found or it doesn't get out. But what if it does? And we see this with the health reporting regulations. Just last week, there was a laptop that was lost that contained something like 50,000 medical records. And that hospital then, under the American medical records rules, has to go and contact each one of those patients to tell them that their confidential medical records might have been lost. And there's litigation that's involved in that. So by doing something like turning on BitLocker, you instantly meet a whole lot of compliance responsibilities around portable devices. So that if someone does leave their machine in the tram or on the bus or at the airport, you suddenly aren't sitting there going, okay, we've got all of this confidential personal information. We have to have a way of, you know, meeting our requirements. And expect, especially after what we saw with the nude photo leaks in the last week or so, that there will be a greater push around the disclosure of personal information. Politicians are starting to cotton onto this stuff, and they're going to start treating organisations differently. So where you might have said, well, we've got BitLocker, it doesn't matter. No, you can't stop people losing laptops. And what you're protecting against there is not, you know, is the legal consequences of that. AppLocker. So I mentioned before that 13% of Fortune 500 networks had Tor clients running on them. Why? Because organisations, even with managed desktops, have problems stopping some sort of binaries running. We've all seen it. The person who's running their particular favourite browser of choice because they can run it as a single executable off a USB stick. And they're going to use that rather than Internet Explorer or whatever your corporate standard is. AppLocker is a set of technologies that's been around again since Server 2008 that allows you to only allow the execution of authorised applications in your environment. You basically create a whitelist of applications that can run, and if the application's not on the whitelist, it will not execute on the computer. Again, some organisations are going, wow, that's way too much work. And other organisations will go, no, look, actually, this is what iOS does. Or this is what Windows RT does. It stops unauthorized applications from running because you've got these digital natives, these kids that are like my son's 11. He knows how to run Minecraft and he's known for a while. And that's what grade sixes do all around the world, is that they're already running networked applications. They know how to go and download a tool from a website that they run and then they can go and watch Game of Thrones on a school computer. And if you don't think that schools are an amazing hacking environment, you haven't met many 15-year-olds who want to get around the school rules. So using AppLocker, make sure and be aware that your digital natives can co-opt your infrastructure. So if you want to control which applications can be run on your network, you're going to need something like AppLocker. With the point-of-sale attacks, the ones that hit Neiman Marcus and Target, the interesting thing about those attacks is that the malware was detected on the point of sale devices, but that their reporting system had not been turned on to remove it. So we're talking with Target, we're talking billions of dollars worth of credit card information stolen. And what they had is they had a system where they were running a version of Windows on their point of sale where people would swipe the credit cards and the malware would sit there and intercept that traffic and then hold it and then once a day squirt it up to another server that was sitting on the Target network and then once every few days would upload that to an FTP server in Russia. And that's how they got all of the credit card information. Now, their Target's internal monitoring system picked up that malware. But they had so many other alerts that they were dealing with that they didn't realise for several months what was actually going on. The other issue there was that the malware was loaded just before the Thanksgiving, and those of you who know about Black Friday in the United States know that that's a huge retail time. So it'd be a very gutsy systems administrator who would press the nuke that file, I don't recognise it, and the file had called itself something like Dell Management Software. So if you're getting an alert saying we don't recognise Dell Management Software on thousands of point of sale devices around the country on your busiest day of the year, would you press C, go and delete this malware button or not? The idea with AppLocker is that you've recognised all of this stuff beforehand and you've pre-approved it, you've put it on a whitelist. So it wouldn't be a matter of, if something's not recognised, it's because you haven't chosen to recognise it. DNSSEC. DNSSEC's a newer technology. What it does is it digitally signs your DNS signs. It ensures that your DNS records are not spoofed. And I'll talk about a device that allows you to sort of do this a little later. But more and more we're seeing internal attacks where someone will take over, they'll put their own DHCP server on the network, that'll point at their own DNS server, and you can get little boxes that do all of this. And then suddenly your computer thinks it's talking to a domain controller and it's intercepting credentials. So DNSSEC, something you can simply turn on your internal network. You configure another thing in group policy called the name resolution policy table. And what that does is the name resolution policy table says for this zone, only accept signed DNS records. So it means that any DNS record is digitally signed so that the client knows the integrity of it. IP address management is a feature of Windows Server 2012 and 2012 R2. It allows you to take one service running on a server and manage every DNS server and DHCP server in your organisation. So if you want to know if a particular scope is nearly exhausted out at a branch office, IPAM will tell you. Centralised management of DHCP, very cool. But where it's even more cool is it has a feature that allows you to track which user was using which IP address at which particular point in time. So that if you are trying to do forensics to figure out where a problem may have occurred, you now have the ability to tie that back to a MAC address, IP address, and a user account so that you know that the person who was trying to hit the CEO file share from this particular IP address on this particular day was this person logged into that computer. And that's the other nice thing. It says, hey, because it goes out and it grabs all of the relevant logs and it aggregates them and says, yes, Bob was logged onto PC214313 out at the Rotorua office at that particular time on that particular day. So again, it's a feature built into the operating system. System Center Endpoint Protection. This is Config Manager, but the reason I wanted to bring it to your attention is that as of Config Manager 2012 and 2012 R2, Forefront Endpoint Protection was built into Config Manager. Now, the advantage of this is that I was talking about looking at monitoring the configuration of computers. Suddenly, you can get all of your antivirus and your anti-malware management through the same console that you are doing the rest of your configuration management. So here's a tool that allows you to manage all of your computer's configuration rather than going off to another computer and another console and managing antivirus separately. What you're doing is you're integrating anti-malware, software updates, firewall, compliance, all from one console. File and folder permissions. Who here thinks that they've got file and folder permissions worked out and that everybody is only able to access the files and folders that they should have be able to access? Who's going to make that claim? Who here is pretty sure that people are able in their organisation to access files and folders that they shouldn't? Yep. File and folder permissions are almost always done incorrectly. It's just, even with 100 Microsoft exam questions on it, when you're looking at share permissions and you're looking at individual NTFS permissions, and then when you've got multiple groups involved, what generally happens is most people go, we think we've got it right, but we're not going to look too look in detail. And given the number of files in an organisation, checking it's almost impossible. The reality is that users often have access to data that they shouldn't be able to access. Bradley Manning was able to go through and surf the State Department's file servers because they didn't have their file and folder permissions done right. Many organisations do not audit or even examine their file and folder permissions. And if you've got someone who's coming in to look at your security and they want to ping you for something easy, that's the easy one that they can ping you on. And it's one that we should all know, and it's one that's very rarely done right. So the way that you can kind of get around this, who here has heard of dynamic access control? Okay, so dynamic access control is a new feature in Server 2012 and 2012 R2 that uses what's called claims-based security. And that is, rather than saying, I'm going to allow so-and-so access to this file if they're a member of this security group, what it instead does, it uses that right at the bottom of the fabric, but it's more, I'm going to allow access to this, I'm going to set up some properties of this file. I'm going to look at the file, I'm going to classify the file based on who authored the file and the contents of the file. So I'm going to make claims about that file based on who wrote the file and what words that appear in the file and the date that the file was created. And I'm going to apply security to that file based on the properties of the file rather than have someone manually apply or have those properties inherited. So of course the other thing with file and folder permissions is you go and move a file onto a USB stick that's formatted with FAT and it takes away your NTFS permissions. With ADRMS, which is another technology I'm not going to talk about, you can even block that sort of attack. So the first part is that you can have files assessed based on their properties, and you have File Server Resource Manager come and assign that metadata to that, and then you configure access rules based on the properties of the user. So the properties of the user's AD user account rather than what groups the user is a member of. So you can assign metadata to the account that says what department the user's in, and that would say, right, if you're in this department and you're not the author of this file and this file contains these keywords, you don't have access to it. And this means that permissions are applied functionally on a regular and automatic basis. Okay, now wireless security. I left this one to last for a reason. Computers and mobile devices automatically connect to recognised wireless networks. We've all done it. Everybody here's got a phone and a computer. When you go home, does your phone automatically connect to the Wi-Fi? Yes. Does your computer automatically connect to the Wi-Fi that you've connected to before? Yes. Have you ever connected to a wireless access point that doesn't have a password? Never? Okay. But who here has? Did you know that your device remembers all of those networks? So, for example, you go into McDonald's, and it all automatically connects to McDonald's, even though there's not a password. Well, there's a thing called a Wi-Fi Pineapple, and you can actually build this out in Linux if you want. And what this device does is it has two aerials on it. The first aerial simply sits there and listens, because what your phone does, what your computer does, is when it's turned on, it says, is this network here? Is this network here? And it goes through the list of networks that it's connected to in the past and broadcasts their name. What this device does is it listens and it hears McDonald's Wi-Fi. And what this one does is this whirs and it says, I'm McDonald's Wi-Fi. And then your computer, without you necessarily knowing it, goes, oh, there's a network I've connected to in the past, and automatically connects to it. So Troy Hunt, who I was talking about before, does a demonstration where he starts off a talk and he goes and puts this on the, he puts the Wi-Fi Pineapple on his the lectern, and he goes through the discussion. And by the end of it, what people are doing is you'll hear it throughout the room. You'll hear, why is Google down? Why has it got a duck on it? Because what it can do is it can hijack your traffic, strip the SSL, inject whatever content it wants. And he does a very benign demonstration. But imagine someone paying $100 and it takes like a week to get here from the United States. And all someone needs to do is put it there. And anybody who's got a computer that once connected to a network without authentication, who hasn't wiped that network, and I'll talk in a minute about how you do the wiping of the networks, you can run this. I'll give you a PowerShell command, a NetShell command in a moment that allows you to see how many networks your computer's remembered. And you will be astonished at how many networks your computer's remembered. All this does is it basically listens for, because your computer gives it the name of the network, and then this simply says, yeah, I'm that network. And then it can pretend to be multiple networks. And he can capture, like, in an audience like this, he can get 50 or 60 people's devices to connect. Because what happens is your phone is most likely configured like everybody else's, which is if it finds a Wi-Fi network, it automatically turns off data through the cellular and then goes through the Wi-Fi. And it won't notify you that it's doing that. It'll just start doing that. And you pick up your phone to do something, and suddenly all of your email has been intercepted. So if you run the command netshare WLAN show profiles on your PC, what that will do is that will show you a list of all of the wireless networks that your computer remembers. If you are running Windows 8 or 8.1, that will be any network that you've connected to while signed into your Microsoft account on any computer. Why? Because what your Microsoft account does is it remembers all of those networks so that when you walk into your friend's place with a new computer, it will automatically go, I've been here on another computer with this Microsoft account, I'm going to authenticate to that network automatically. So you use this second one, NetShare WLAN delete profile name equals profile name, to delete each network that you want. But you will find, like I did, even though I cleaned it out 6 months ago, I did it on my the laptop I bought to this conference, and I still had 30 networks remembered. Anyway, to summarise, security is a process. There's different things you can do. And just the simple ones I've covered today are account security practices, service account practices, role-based access control, your network security, and anti-malware, and also your file and folder permissions. In terms of related content, you can get a hold of me at Oren Thomas on Twitter, but thank you very much for your attention. You.